I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Welcome back aboard the Starship Texas for the 279th installment of the Text Trek podcast, the home of Star Trek fandom from deep in the heart of Texas, where we take a deep look at Star Trek, old and new. And tonight, we are talking about Star Trek Discovery, seasons 1 through 4, the entire show's history up until now, and all of our favorite highlights, things, contributions to the Star Trek franchise, anything we want to talk about in Disco that we appreciate. It's just a big, big old Discovery appreciation celebration.
Yeah, broad spectrum.
And Dave and I are lucky enough to have our friend from the BQN podcast network, Miss Amy Nelson, joining us. Amy, yay. How are you doing?
Hi, I am doing so great. Thank you so much for inviting me on to your amazing show. 279, that's pretty awesome.
Thank you so much.
I bow.
Woo!
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to be here, and you have a lot of podcast experience under your belt. You've been podcasting the entire time Discovery's been around. I remember like Disco season one when I was listening to other Trek podcasts to see what are other people saying about this new Star Trek show. I remember you were doing a show at that time called The Edge.
Uh-huh, and postcards from the Edge.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I wrote into there one time. Y'all, I think y'all actually like read some of my comments
course.
On there. So
yeah, it was fun. Just the excitement to have Star Trek back on the airwaves, and yeah. I was doing the viewers' response show, and it was super fun to see what everyone had to think about it.
Well, I want to ask you more about your Star Trek fandom and let you tell us a little bit about yourself before we talk about Discovery in just a moment. I got a little bit of quick housekeeping to do. I have to give a big thank you and shout out to the wonderful Text Trek Patreon supporters. That's Starfleet, Sohel, Cake is Eternal, Crazy Dutchie, Joanne Robertson, John Daw, Geek Filter, Quarkspar, Stephanie Durantas, Matthew Averett, Braxton, Chuck A, Joel Valisok, and our anonymous supporters. We do like to celebrate with a monthly Patreon watch party every month, and we have one coming up on April 13th. It's going to be a big one. We're going to do a Star Trek movie. We're actually going to do Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. It's the 40th anniversary this year. That happens to be my all-time favorite Star Trek movie. I know I'm a minority, but I think there's a lot to love in the Leonard Nimoy-directed Search for Spock.
I don't think there's a lot of hate for it, I'll say that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think people are generally pretty on board.
When you're sandwiched between 2 and 4, it's hard to stand out, you know?
But there are somehow a few pretty notable things that happen in it. And by the way, our last watch-along was a very fun time as we celebrated St. Patrick's Day with
Up the Long Ladder.
Up yeah. the Long Ladder. Oh, boy. That was fun.
That was a fun one. But yeah, it's always a fun time. A great group of people that show up for the mm-hmm. Patreon watch parties. So I'm really looking forward to that on April 13th. That's also around like my birthday, so I feel like I'm having a birthday party with all of y'all. So
that's right. Really yeah, you got to remind us, and it's your favorite, so it's a present to you too, Fathery.
But yeah, that will be on Saturday afternoon, April 13th. You can come into the Patreon as little as $2 a month, and if you can afford to be more generous, there's additional perks as well. But $2 a month will get you into all the monthly watch parties, and it's a good time to join now because in May we're going to have multiple watch parties. There's some speaking of birthdays, there's some birthday celebrations that we're doing for some Patreon supporters. So be sure to check that out and join and attend those watch parties. But as far as Star Trek Discovery goes, all 4 previous seasons, looking forward to talking about this with Miss Amy Nelson. So You currently have, what, two Star Trek podcasts that you're doing? Or three? Yeah, there's three podcasts that you're on right now?
Yeah, ish. You know, take a break busy now and then.
Yeah. And that's so all over on BQN, right?
Yeah, on BQN Podcast Network. So we're doing right now live, which was my very first live show, called The View Screen. And we have our very last bonus episode for season one, where we're going to do a discovery in collaboration with Strange New Pods, their last day of Disco Festival. And so we're going to have a View Screen dedicated to Discovery. So more talking Discovery. But then that ends that season, and then I'll pick up All Good Things, which is sort of my normal every week podcast. And then Union Federation, which we cover the new Trek and the Orville when it was, but so now it's just a new Trek. So I will be, when there's new Trek, doing two podcasts a week.
Have you had a nap lately? Are you feeling okay? It's a lot to juggle.
Well, I sort of like took some time off of work. I'm sort of changing flows. So I've got a little bit more time to be focused on podcasting, and I enjoy it. I love it.
Yeah, it's a fun thing to be immersed in. I was talking with someone the other day, and I realized I've been doing some sort of podcast before this, more comic related stuff, for off and on for like the last 15 years. And I still do a weekly one with with the comic and game shop I manage. And it's, when you're talking about stuff you like, it's good times.
It is.
And Amy, I mentioned that you've been podcasting on this entire modern era of Star Trek Discovery and all the shows that have followed, but just a little bit more about yourself and your relationship with Star Trek and your personal fandom experience. Kind of what was your fan experience before this modern era? What were the shows that you were into, and when did you become a fan?
Well, I am definitely a TNG baby. My mother high school, 88, 89, said, "Hey, come sit down." It was Sunday night, 6 p.m. And I was like, "Oh my gosh, I like this show." So I watched it here and there, but you know, you're going to school and university. But in 2000, when the TNG DVDs came out, that's when I was all in. I was like, give me Star Trek. I went to the library. I was checking out books, reading everything, just consuming anything TNG. And that's where my love started. And then I started podcasting in 2016 at the end of the 50th. It's November of that, of 2016, is when I started podcasting, and I've been doing it ever since.
You know, it's nice when Trek is like there for us. You know, you're talking about like when you did the big deep dive, and you know, sometimes it's just like a really fun time to fill your life with something Star Trek. But also sometimes it's like, you know, people will hit Trek when they're not feeling great, and you know, it's there for you. Trek is a hug sometimes.
Yes,
that was
is
an exciting time when the Berman era Star Trek started releasing on DVD box sets. I remember that was the first time I ever saw an entire season of a television series collected in like one box that you could purchase. That was revolutionary at the time.
Size was scaling down.
Yeah. Because before that, they had been putting out TNG on like all those VHS tapes. They only had like two per tape, two episodes per tape.
And the special features and the commentaries, like I just consumed it all. I could not get enough.
And yeah, still can't, so it seems. But that's good.
Just talking about like Discovery itself, and you mentioned that was a very exciting moment in 2017, just getting like new Star Trek again after it felt like we were starved for so long, you know. I guess let's talk about just like early Discovery a little bit, and just kind of when it like first arrived. You know, it was so different from any previous show. It was a bit jarring, I think, for a lot of fans. But in a way, that's kind of a Star Trek tradition, right? The TNG actors famously talk about how no one appreciated them when they first showed up. And I remember in the 90s, everyone complaining about, you know, Voyager and DS9 not being as good as TNG or the original series.
Here's a quick question, and I think I already know the answer to this. Is there any Trek series that when it from the get-go was just like pretty much completely accepted? The only thing I can think of that kind of falls into that is maybe Lower Decks. I know not everyone was on board, but like I feel like it was pretty well accepted pretty quick.
I don't know. There's a lot of Lower Deck haters out there, I think.
I think to answer that question, in my opinion, I would say Voyager, because Deep Space Nine was so radical. Ooh, it's a space, it's a station. It's not going anywhere. And we're going back to a spaceship. We're going back to the episodes more like TNG. I feel like Voyager was just super accepted and everyone was happy to be going back to a spaceship. So I think Voyager, in my opinion.
Okay. Yeah, I am one of those, arguably a Lower Decks hater, or more like a Lower Decks indifferenter. But I never got on board it completely. So, but yeah, like you're right. It's a Trek tradition. The that fans are a little resistant when you get rolling.
But there is also, I think, a lot of in that kind of weirdness, the uniqueness of Discovery. In kind of breaking format.
Yeah, those early elements that are the, who was it, the Brian Fuller elements definitely sort of stood out. Spore drives, a little more violent, a little bit more sweary, tardigrades, and...
violent, sweary tardigrades. I picture the tardigrade as the one, like, dropping F-bombs.
Like Ripper with a cigar. And,
yeah, turning people inside out, and...
But Father, do you remember, I'm sure you do, that I had a tough time with those first two episodes?
You really didn't like the first two at all, the Shinjo episodes, which I appreciate them more on. I was kind of indifferent on those. I was kind of like, I need more of the show to figure out how I feel about it. But like going back, I've always kind of liked those more on rewatch, to the point to where like I kind of wish that we had a Philippa Georgiou Prime Universe captain of the Shenzhou show and Michael Burnham and Saru, you know, serving under her command. I kind of wish we had more than just the two episodes of that.
I had trouble connecting with their bridge crew, you know, early on, and I wanted that family vibe to start building, and that didn't happen for me until the third episode when Michael gets onto the Discovery. How about you, Amy? Were you kind of in there immediately, or did it take a little bit to get you on board, or what?
Well, it was told to us that these two episodes are going to be like this little prologue. So I was prepared to like, okay, this is catching me up. What's going on? But yeah, in my rewatch, I definitely prefer starting at episode 3. Like I skipped 1 and 2. Well, because I had recently seen it, but yeah, those first two episodes, they're good, but I really like it with Lorca for season 1.
A lot happens in that third episode. I when I was kind of going through this, I didn't do a full rewatch, but you know, I forgot the first appearance of Ripper the Tardigrade too. Mm-hmm. I mean,
the first,
you know,
appearance of all the Discovery
everybody
crew.
Yeah, but like, yeah, big scenes for Tilly, Stamets, Lorca, and all of which, you know, actually, you know, when you look back, I'm like, pretty solid. You know, yes, they still had to find their place, but Stamets, you know, had his persona for that first season more prickly. Tilly was Tilly, I think, right from the beginning, and you know, Ripper, of course, was Ripper right from the get-go, shredding people in there.
But I think Lorca was probably a big highlight for season 1 for a lot of people. I'd be curious if anyone in the live audience watching has any other big highlights from season 1 that stand out to them and their memories. But just talking about like Lorca, Jason Isaacs' performance, that was such a big mystery, because we were all like, what the hell is going on with the Starfleet captain? There's something weird about him. And I think that was kind of frustrating for some people who didn't want a long-form story arc drawn out mystery, right, in Star Trek. They wanted, no, I want to have like a weekly planet adventure. You know, give me a planet of the week this week and then a different story next week. And they were a little frustrated that they were having to deal with this different format, but a lot of people, I think, enjoyed Jason Isaacs to the point to where there's a big demand for like, find Prime Universe Lorca, bring Jason Isaacs back to Star
Trek. He was a very charismatic captain. You know, he had some of that play by his own rules kind of vibe to him, but there was also the mystery of, yeah, what was going on in there. Yeah, he was, you know, I think, And Trek viewers, I think, are trained to look to the captain, even though the show is kind of trying to differentiate itself and have Burnham be the central character but not be the captain, which I think was a good idea, although it's funny, it ended up settling. That's where we still landed. But
that was always the intent. I think Brian Fuller wanted to get her in the captain's chair eventually.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, so I was just going to say, that's why I think when we saw Lorca, it was like a little bit of a life preserver. If you weren't quite feeling what was going on before, and that, you know, I think people like Michelle Yeoh, but, you know, that was all chaos over there. And there was at least the stability of a sort of a ship that was running as, you know, without a war going on. And so Lorca got to be a little bit of a stabilizing influence on early Discovery, I think.
In 2018, I went to the Fan Expo in Salt Lake City, and Jason Isaacs was there, and he was asked multiple times, you know, would you come back to Discovery? What's going on? And he loved it. He was like, yes, I would so come back. And so I still am hoping that we get Jason Isaacs. I absolutely love him. But yeah, his character was very frustrating, and that's what we loved about him. And like his relationship with Burnham and like how he treated the crew. And I just found him so fascinating and so different that it was really shocking to my system. And that's why he's memorable.
It's interesting to go back and rewatch that knowing what we know, knowing that yeah. he is a mirror universe infiltrator.
It is so different. Yes. Knowing what we know, seeing it again.
And knowing his relationship with Burnham and how big yes. of a creep he is.
Yeah, that's...
Yes.
That makes it a little harder to like him. but the way
but yeah,
he
we're not supposed to like him. The big arc of season one is you think like, oh, maybe in times of Klingon war, maybe we need this different type of Starfleet captain. Maybe we need like this tough guy like Lorca. And then you realize at the end, like, no, that's like crazy evil mirror universe talk. Like that guy's no bueno. He's bad. He's a creep.
Yeah, sometimes we get somebody like Shaw on Picard, who's, you know, a kind of obnoxious person, but ends up being, yes, this is actually somebody we're going to grow to like, and they're going to grow a little bit. Lorca ended up not being that guy. But somewhere out there is possibly a prime Lorca, so...
So Jill in the comments says, Michael owes her career to Lorca. Discuss. Jill, you are spot on. The fact that he brings her back and like
that
pushes
true,
against
yeah.
Starfleet. It's like, I have the right. We are in time of war and I have the right to call any officer, to call any person to work with me. And I'm calling this person. So yeah, we have Burnham because of Lorca.
Michael Burnham would have ended up working, doing prison labor in a penal colony, had this crazy guy from the mirror universe yep. not wanted to abduct her and put her to work on his ship because he had a relationship with her in the universe he came from.
Yeah. It's a bit weird to think about it like, oh, thank God for stalkers. But but yes, it's, you know, arguably that's he was moving chess pieces around and that ended up bad, actually, ultimately for him. He ended up miscalculating there, yeah. but it is true. Yeah, that's how it happened. I forget. She was in the penal shuttle. They were going off to prison. What drew her exactly to Disco?
The Disco came to them.
Mm-hmm. Did they have like a breakdown, or did they literally just fly
no,
up?
No, they saved them from the nebula that was eating up their shuttle.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Yeah, I remember early confrontations and stuff with some of the, you know, there were some prisoners that came on Disco and made a fuss.
Yeah, that was all in that same episode context mm-hmm. as for Kings. Just to jump away from season one a little bit, but still talk about characters and performances, we got a very different captain in season two with Anson Mounts Pike. You know, it gave us Anson Mounts Pike, so we have to credit season two of Discovery with that.
I mean, huge. That's huge. And it's an interesting experiment, too, because it was a season that was, you know, a test drive for its own show.
I just really want to point out season one, as we sort of were talking, like they are getting to know each other. And what I loved about it is that they're sort of snippy with each other. Like Burnham is like telling Tilly how to become a captain because she thinks she knows best. And there is this totally funny quote that I so love that made me laugh. And like Burnham and Stamets were in engineering and, Stamets was blaming Burnham. Well, this is all your fault, you know, because she caused the war, Klingon war and stuff. And Stamets is like, what are you doing with your mouth? And she's like, I am swallowing the urge to set the record straight. Like the writing in season one was so good, so back and forth and just getting to know each other. I really love those episodes from like season three up to Mirror Universe. Those middle episodes are my favorite of season one for that reason.
Father, slightly, but before we get back to Pike, I'll say one thing about Lorca that's a season one thing. I think one of their funniest scenes, and it is darkly funny as season one tended towards, was Rainn Wilson, Harry Mudd, montage of killing
him. The murder montage, yeah.
Yes, the, what is that, magic to make the sanest man go mad?
Yeah, which is another fun thing I liked about early Discovery is the episode titles. They tried, like, TOS had these, Dave and I talk about this a lot because we're both big TOS fanboys, but TOS had, like, the best episode titles. Like, these very, like, I don't know, they're just like, when you hear something like The Savage
Devil
Curtain,
in the Dark,
or, sorry, yeah, Devil in the Dark, The Enemy Within, Balance of
the
Terror.
The World is Hollow and...
For the world is hollow and I have touched the sky. Yeah, there's something kind of just enticing and poetic. Yeah, and beautiful. And I feel like DS9 tried to do that a little bit, kind of after Ira took over in season 3. You know, we would get some stuff like Tears of the Prophets and stuff like that. But I think that early Disco really tried to, you know, we got away from like the boring TNG episode titles that are just kind of, you know, like a single word, like
The Wounded, The Hunted.
Yeah.
Yeah, context is for kings, and
Butcher's knife cares not for the lamb's cry.
Yeah, yes, almost maybe beautiful. A little overly on that one. That was a little stretch,
like the Vulcan hello. Like when we first heard, the first two episodes are called The Vulcan Hello and The Battle at the Binary Stars. I'm like, oh, those sound like exciting titles. I want to know what those stories are about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, The Vulcan Hello is actually a great title.
Yeah, it's kind of mysterious. Like, Vulcan Hello, what the hell could that possibly mean?
Now, Father, you mentioned Pike, and I think, like, I was just almost instantly on board when Pike rolls up onto the bridge and he introduces himself and asks the rest of the bridge crew to introduce themselves. That's one of my very favorite Pike scenes ever.
And it was such an injection of a new energy and vibrance into the show that like, from that scene on until... I think now going into season 5, it was like it never left, you know, it's kind of like you have like pre-Pike Disco and then Anson steps on that bridge and it turns into post-Pike Disco. The show is always, it kind of like that mirror universe, whatever grim, dark lingerings from season 1. I'm not necessarily like saying that stuff was bad. I kind of like having like that variety of flavor mixed in the blend, but like all of that was kind of like shooken off as soon as Pike stepped on that bridge, I think.
Yep, something about him just called back, not just the imagination of the viewership, but I think the writers took them back to, you know, TOS, TNG, the idealism side of it. Although in season 1, I have to say, I one of my broad listings for, like, favorite scenes, you know, over all these seasons is Saru and his speeches. And I think he's my favorite character pretty clearly. And in season 1, when they're in the Mirror Universe, I loved his short rallying speech before they went after big time Lorca and his like that giant capital ship. And, you know, when he says, you know, this is not Lorca's ship anymore, this is our ship, and today is her maiden voyage. That's one of my favorite scenes. And that, you know, that had elements of classic Trek, too. There was some Pike in that before Pike.
Yeah, that's kind of the first... glimpse of Captain Saru, of like good leadership Saru. I guess we saw him like kind of struggling with command early on, but this is the first time he ever seemed in command and confident about being in command.
It was nice to see an arc that he was not that person in episode 1.
Yeah. Amy, what do you think about Saru and Doug Jones's performance as Saru overall?
Absolutely love it. And especially in season 2 with the whole Kelpian and his threat ganglia, I remember it. People were just brutal first round. But in my rewatch, it really shows this beautiful arc of him developing and coming into his own and pushing past boundaries that you didn't even think was possible. Like, it's just an analogy for us in our lives. You know, what did we think was impossible, but yet when faced with it, pushed through and came out on the other side stronger and better. Like, that is so beautiful. For Saru to tell that. And then we get to see it with Pike's like, I don't think that you would have made that decision before. And he's like, yeah, you're right. He's like, yeah, we don't handle violence. Like when Tyler and Culber were fighting, you know.
Yeah.
And Pike's like, no, we don't do that. And I understand why you thought that, because now you feel empowered and you're not this afraid anymore. But we're not going to do that. And so I just really enjoy that exploration that Saru has with his arc.
Yeah, if people recall the fight between Culber and Tyler, because Culber was like, "You snapped my neck and killed me, and now I'm back, and I have a lot of emotions I need to process. I'm going to beat your ass right now."
in like the cafeteria
in the mess hall,
right?
And Saru is like, let them fight, you know, he's like the Godzilla meme, he's like, let them fight, and Pike is like, no, like, no, we don't do that. But that was when Saru was like, Doug Jones had to explain this before I understood it, but I heard like Doug Jones explain in an interview that like post Gangula Saru, he went through like an angry teenager phase, kind of like the second half of season two, you know, he's kind of like angry teenager, and then he kind of restabilizes, I guess, like going into season three when he has to step up and be the captain without, you know, Daddy Pike is gone, he's back in the 23rd century, so Saru has to mature and become the grown up, and when he does that, you kind of see like in season three he starts to become a softer commander. He softens on people. He becomes more more kind of paternal and kind of more of like a comforting type leader.
You know, Father, early on we talked about this, and they, I think it was how they originally wanted to stage his relationship with Michael was as like the kind of brother and sister with a sort of rival.
Right, sibling rivalry, yeah.
But as he like kind of went through those teenage years and kind of matured, he took on, you know, it was as if he kind of aged beyond older, and then he felt like now when they see each other and they hug and they have this, they reconnect and things like that, I feel like he's like a father figure. That's interesting. I think that's a good growth that wasn't necessarily spelled out throughout the show, but that is where things landed.
Yeah, and I think that their relationship really changed a lot in season one when they are betrayed by Lorca, and it's like, oh, like, you know, Mom is dead, you know, Giorgio's gone, you know, she was our captain, right. She always had the answers before, but she's gone, and then our stepdad betrayed us. It turned out he was not a good guy at all. So you and I, we're gonna have to mature. We're like big brother, big sister. You know, all the other kids on the ship aren't gonna make it unless you and I step up and work together and put all of our rivalry stuff aside. And they do that. And then like in season two, when Michael is, you know, watching Saru, they think he's gonna die. You know, we see how like tore up she is. And there's something there that kind of always confused me, Dave. I don't know if you remember, but when we talked about season two, I always thought it was like weird when she's telling him like, of all the souls I've encountered, you're the most empathic. And that always seemed like weird to me. I was like, I felt like they were changing course with Saru. They weren't going to make him like this anxiety riddled, you know, like constantly scared, a predator type alien that he was in season one. They were gonna do something like very different, but just rewatching season two recently, I understood that scene more now. What they're trying to say is that like his fear sense, his like Gangula sense of always, you know, watching out for threats, he has a awareness, and that if he stops being afraid for a second, he can actually like use that to, you know, be empathetic to the people around him. You know, he can pick up on those vibes and stuff. And you can kind of see like that transition of like, oh yeah, after he does like gain the confidence, after he does, you know, kind progress past like that living in fear all the time.
It's like, yeah, his interaction. So much more,
he's able
his
to give back to
with
everyone
people,
else. Yeah.
Fear is now out of the equation, or a much less part of the equation. And so he can kind of wrap his mind better around those things, be a little bit more of a complete human being for a Kelpian.
Yeah. But I never really connected all that stuff together, but it makes the like the early Saru that we get in like seasons one, season two connect up to the guy that we see, you know, dating President Serena or Tarina. Serena's his sister, Tarina's his girlfriend, but like later in season four.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we get that, and he's maturing and going through his teenage years and angst, and then, yeah, he's, you know, being a better friend and a better commander, and then in season four, we get this beautiful relationship with Tarina, and again, that starts with season one and his personal growth.
Yeah, and they do tiptoe up. They are not, this is not a fast-moving relationship.
Oh, I love it.
Oh, something else that I just thought of, trying to think of like other like cool actors and performances in Disco, but Kenneth Mitchell, we got four different characters from him in Discovery. I know he did some other characters on Lower Decks too, but I think just in Disco he had four. He was three different Klingons, and then Aurelio, the scientist in season three who worked for the Emerald Chain.
Yeah, a little bit of oh my God, why can't I suddenly say his name? The actor who's everybody.
Jeffrey Combs.
The little Jeffrey Combs there, yeah. Yeah, pretty cool, a pretty cool legacy to have there.
Yeah, that was very interesting doing my rewatch, especially after the cruise, after his passing, and like, oh, there he is. Oh, there's Cole Shaw. They're a little painful, but then recognizing his brilliant acting behind all the prosthetics.
Oh my God.
Incredible.
Yeah, some of those actors, and by the way, just as a quick aside, jumping back to Doug Jones for a second, you know, the physicality of Saru is a big part of what makes it, and everybody knows that Saru walk, which it actually looks like it'd be extremely hard to pull off with the wave in hands, and, you know, walking around on whenever they need to show, I guess, the prosthetics that elevate his height and give him his little hoofs. Yeah, there's a physical quality to the character, and that I think honestly his height sort of gives him a little of the paternal thing. That's a little bit part of it. Is he, and he doesn't, he's sort of lean and he doesn't look threatening, but he looks like he'd give good hugs.
Well, Doug Jones famously loves to hug fans at conventions. Yeah. So I've never gotten a Doug hug. Amy, have you gotten one?
Yes, I have.
Yay.
Well, yeah. Thank you so much to Matthew Averett for the very generous $10 super chat in the live audience. Matthew says, mixed feelings about season 5. Excited to see it, but sad to see Discovery go. I feel like there is more character building to do. Sorry if this is off topic. And Matthew. And if anyone else has feelings on season 5 they want to share in the live chat, please go ahead. But yeah, I mean, I think that 5 seasons is a really like strong run for especially for like a modern TV show. I think that there could have been, you know, potential for more, but just I don't know, the way that the showrunner Michelle Paradise has talked about how she's feeling really confident that season 5 is going to be a strong ending for the show, and the little glimpses that we've seen, Dave and I have both seen the first episode of season 5, and we feel like it might actually be a good story to close things out on for what they seem to be planning to do for the season 5 arc. So you know, we'll see, but I definitely understand being sad to go, but there's no reason why these characters can't, you know, show up in more Star Trek. Like we just had like Star Trek last year that had Ro Laren running around and and Riker and Tuvok and you know, I'm gonna see the Voyager Doctor this year at some point. We don't know when. Netflix hasn't told us when, but I'm gonna see him on Prodigy at some point. So
Seven got a huge new lease on life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even Icheb was there briefly.
Yes. And Hugh.
And Hugh, yeah.
Aww.
Yeah, so I doubt we've seen the last of the Disco Crew.
But I kind of agree, though, with, like you know, as we're revisiting it, I am kind of like, what? Maybe it should have gone Seven. You know, what? That would have been kind of cool. We're probably going to see Tilly, though, right? She's almost certainly going to be in Lower Decks.
Or the Starfleet Academy.
Starfleet Academy.
Maybe Lower Decks, too. I don't know. But, yeah, Starfleet Academy.
Whenever the actors are asked, whenever any of these Discovery actors are asked, like, could you appear on that Academy show? They're all like, oh, yeah, yeah, I don't see why I couldn't. So they seem to think that, you know, they seem to think that they're going to have an open door to showing up on there, you know, that it might be in the same time period. I think it will be.
Can we talk about Laurel? And Jill has a comment that says, Volk, Cole, and Laurel were enthralling.
Oh, yeah. I remember Jill often says that she likes the season one Klingons.
Yes. Absolutely. And Laurel is one of my standout characters of Discovery. First of all, for Mary Chifo, I love that she still keeps coming to the conventions and the cruise. Mm-hmm. Like, she is there. Huge, awesome for the fans. She loves us. We love her. Yay. So huge shout out to her. But her beautiful arc, and especially on my rewatch, noticing how strategic she is, where she is starting at the very bottom. Like, she's a nobody, and she's like, oh, here's a Volk. Maybe I'll hitch my train to his ride. But then that doesn't happen. Then she gets tortured by Cole. She gets captured by Starfleet and then ends up over there and all of a sudden becomes important. And then she has to give up her ultimate sacrifice, in quotes, of her child and, you know, disowning Volk and not having Ash Tyler there, like, and becoming this chancellor and mother and uniting the Klingon houses. What a beautiful story arc for Laurel. And to see her go from season one to season two, she's like my all-time favorite character for those two seasons. I love Laurel. Did I miss anything? I think it's good.
Yeah, that's a good, great encapsulation of it. The Klingons come. Do they show up to like help in the battle at the end of season two?
Yeah, the mm-hmm. end of season two, and such mm-hmm. sweet sorrow parts one and two. And Laurel has that really cool moment in there. I really love watching Mary Chifo's acting when they're watching Michael Burnham in the Red Angel suit go into the wormhole, go into the future, and the Discovery following her. And Ash Tyler is watching the view screen, and he's sad because he's in love with Michael Burnham. You know, there goes the love of his life, you know, flying away out of his life, out of the 23rd century, into the future. And he's so sad. But then you see behind him, Laurel, Chancellor Laurel, staring at him, being so sad, like, oh my God, he really was like so in love with Michael Burnham, and I never stood a chance, and like, I'll never have him, and he's as lost to me as Michael Burnham is lost to him. And like, it's a really like painful, tragic moment, and it's all just conveyed through Mary Chifo's eyes that sells it all to the audience.
Yes, and she has that realization a little bit before, but sometimes it takes multiple times of getting kicked in the face that, yeah, this guy doesn't like you. And she has that, like, you know, when Ash Tyler's there and she's with him and like holding his hand, and she's like, we were together, we were love. And he's like, when you touch me, I don't feel that. I feel
violated.
Violated, that's right. The word. And her, again, her eyes, it's like a snap, and it's like, and she recoils back because she doesn't want to be that torturer. Like, right, she right. loves, and you know that what they had back in season one was so real for her. And we get that in just that small moment, like, again, her acting. And she said that on the cruise. She's like, I've been told that I have great eye acting.
I wasn't at the panel when she said that, but I'm glad. Yeah. I'm glad that people have told her that, because I'm clearly complimenting it here. So I'm glad.
Yeah. When you're under all that makeup too, and to be able to do that.
Yeah. Like, what the hell else are you going to do? You got to become a good eye actor at that point.
Well, there is an option, and that that option is you're not a good eye actor, and the character isn't that memorable and all that stuff. But she was not that person. You know, speaking of Ash Tyler, early on, you know, it's funny, he's been so supplanted by Book, who's obviously feels so right, I think, with Burnham. But early on, you know, I was rooting for him, and one of my favorite scenes in the first season, I mean, Father, you remember, because I've mentioned it a million times, is the party scene in using magic to make the sanest man go mad. Mm-hmm. And you know, like, aside from, like, there's actually lots of good stuff in there. Stamets kind of teaching her to dance and all that, and the stuff with Lorca's many deaths. But I always liked that party scene because it looked like a bumpin' party. It was fun to see characters like Tilly drunk. Poor awkward Burnham trying to come to terms with, you know, at that point, she was just wrapping her head around her being attracted to him, and maybe something more, but she was like that, had that Vulcan reserve that was not ready for it yet. But anyway, that I always really enjoyed the party scene in it.
I enjoy that Michael could have like that good, like, awkward first relationship with Tyler so that she could like work all that out and figure out how to be in love with someone, and then could be in a much better relationship, or I think like a more entertaining, funner to watch relationship that I get more invested in. With Book.
The only thing I like about Tyler and Burnham is when she's walking in the mess hall and he puts his foot on the chair to squish the chair out. That's the only thing I like about it. I can't stand them together. I don't like their chemistry. I don't like the acting together. It just falls completely flat to me.
Now that I've sort of seen Book, I kind of agree. When you're in your like first season, there is this, and to some degree, it's like, oh, you put characters together that the writers clearly want to suggest have a thing. Sometimes I will go along for that ride, and I'm like, yeah, okay, that's sure. But it is true. It feels like a maybe slightly awkward first love, and that so it's kind of fitting that it's short lived. Though this was a far more dramatic first relationship, I guess, than people tend to have.
I don't know. Like, I get worried about like Michael and Book. Like when they're on the outs. Like when they are against each other in season four. I'm really worried. I'm like, oh no, are they gonna get back together? And then I was like, all the stuff, I guess, in season three, you know, they have such good chemistry right off the bat that I guess they do kind of the cliche TV thing of like a will they, won't they, when like, oh, these two people were couriers together for a year and they were just friends, though. But, you know, they clearly like each other and who knows, maybe they'll get together. And I kind of don't like when they draw that out. You know, we've all seen that story drawn out way too long on television. But I'm glad that they did like get them together. And then I thought they did interesting stuff in season four with like, oh no, maybe they're, you know, like when they do like the next phase of like the will they, won't they, that can get like so annoying in TV shows of like these couples that, you know, they break up and they get back together and break up and get back together. But I feel like they've handled Book and Burnham pretty well.
Okay. I did not see that as will they or won't they. I feel, and I agree, I think Book and Burnham are fabulous together. They have a good solid relationship, especially after their year together that we didn't see, which I would love to see more of. And I think maybe some people could agree that they're just more like a buddy vibe, which
I think it was Boat Wreck who, yeah, who mentioned
yeah,
that.
But I wish, and I get it why Star Trek didn't do it, but I wish that there was more of that sexual physicality between them. Like, it's an adult show. I can handle seeing some skin on skin between Book and Burnham. And so when I see them in season four, where they have this conflict, to me, it's just like, oh, well, they're having a disagreement. They're figuring out how to work it out, as in every relationship. You have to figure out, how are you going to get through this one thing? And then they're going to be stronger on the other side. That's how I read season four. Like, they are committed. They're together. Had we seen more physicality between them, I think it would have come across. But that's how I'm reading it in my head.
Well, sure. But I mean, like, when you disagree with your partner, and then like you hijack a ship and a weapon and you go off and you might like start like a intergalactic war or something, you're kind of like, oh, like at somewhere in the back of your head, you got to be thinking like, oh, this might break us up. Like, I don't know what this is going to do to our relationship. So,
but, oh, that there know, might be a deal breaker there.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seemed like whenever they ran into each other, there was like, you know, whether it was at council chamber meetings or at the casino, you know, they kind of rededicated themselves. They would say, oh, I don't want to do this. This hurts me. And so, yes, they seemed like they were still pretty tight throughout that. Yes. It was obvious that it was painful that they were on opposite sides of the yes. issue.
Oh, I think that's why yes. that relationship works so much, is that they give each other space. I think I might have mentioned this a couple of weeks ago when we were doing our season four retrospective, but I feel like Michael Burnham and Book both, they're both like big people that like move in like big ways, and they give each other like the space to like, oh, you do your, you know, Starfleet, you're going to be like the badass Maverick Starfleet captain thing. I'm going to be over here like cool courier, might be kind of shady, who knows which way I'm gonna break kind of guy, right. And we're gonna respect each other and allow each other to be true to ourselves as like these big personalities.
You know, it's almost the given his, you know, slightly his sort of unlawful side, it's a little glimpse of the Picard Vosh relationship, if that had been pursued
kind of yeah it's a bit of that.
With him as the kind of wild one in this now, and her as, you know, she is wilder than Picard, too. She is a little bit more prone to dramatic swings. But yes, Vosh was from outside of Starfleet, and yeah, that it's just a little, at least a little reflection of how that could have gone. You know, you mentioned that scene. I wish we had seen a little bit more, like you were saying, Amy, a little bit more adult romance in it sometimes. One of the things I liked about the party is that it looked like these guys were knocking a few back, and that there was probably going to be some shenanigans after hours after this party. Tilly, although she had always been awkward, it looked like when she had some alcohol in it, it calmed her down a little bit, and she was talking as if she had kind of gone through, and I'm not saying this in a judgmental way, a slut phase in the past, and this is like, to reclaim that, Tilly. I liked that, and I thought that was fun, and I had hoped we would see more of that from any given characters. But there's a little bit of Disco is very wholesome sometimes, almost just a touch too wholesome. And by the way, Father, you mentioned Burnham and Book kind of giving themselves their space. That is an interesting also counterpoint to Culber and Stamets, who once they're together, minus one death for a short time, or some not too short a time, but they're pretty close. They're like they're like a couple that, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah.
They go like, to bed each other every night. Like, it's
your problems are my problems. Like, we're going to teamwork all of it. Yeah,
like a 1950s or 1960s sitcom couple. They're in bed together. How was your day?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. But that's another like fun thing that a lot of people, I mean, I don't want to speak for this community, but I've seen so many fans talk about the queer representation in Discovery being better than any previous Star Trek show. And I, Culber sure. and Stamets, I think yeah. obviously embody a lot of that. Is they're kind of like the elder gaze of the show, I guess. And then you have like yes. the younger Gray and Adira, and also like Jet Reno being around. But there's some great scenes. I love like the friendship between Stamets and Reno, and how like they really like they don't get along, but they still kind of like each other, even though like they're so different. And they really like embody kind of like they're very much representative of, it's kind of like, you know, like the bitchy queen gay dude, and you get like the stereotypical like, you know, kind of gruff butch lesbian mm-hmm. woman over here. But I feel like, you know, people in those communities feel like they've been handled very well. And I know the show has gotten a lot of, what do you call it? Like certain organizations have pointed them out as like, oh, yeah.
Respect Discovery. And props.
Yeah, yeah. Respect.
Yeah, from
props,
like GLAAD, sure. I suspect, and yeah. some of the other ones.
Well, because it's not in your face. Well, okay. There has, people say, well, it's in your face. And then people are like, it's not in your face. I truly believe, like you were just saying, those examples of Culber, Stamets, Jet Reno, like it's just, they're there, but the way that they are is representative. Like that's just who they are.
Right. It just comes off as natural. It's very natural yes. and organic.
Yeah. And then you get, well, the Adira and
Gray
are, that's pushed in your face. And I'm like, well, is it? I don't know. It was difficult having the Stamets, Culber, like be the parents and embracing them. That was just a little forced for me, but their characters I loved seeing. So I can sort of see it both ways. But yeah, for sure, Stamets and Culber, like amazing relationships. And I have a question. Who's the, Tark and Four? Do you think that he was in a homosexual relationship?
Oh. Yeah, we talked about this briefly the other week since they didn't quite show it. But yeah. Father, you were reminding me.
I mean, like they're physically close. Yeah, like they're like, but I mean, like their bed is kind of like a makeshift cot because they're kind of in like their prison laboratory. But they're physically cuddling with one another. But I don't know. It could have been an asexual relationship. But when Michael Burnham tries to explain Tarka to the 10C, and she's explaining like, yeah, like my one who's like really dear to me, my one book, you know, died, and the guy right. the reason this guy Tarka was so upset is like his one, the one really close to him, he was trying to get back to.
Yeah.
So in Michael Burnham's mind, the way it was explained to her, and I think the only reason why she knows this is because Jet Reno was taken prisoner on Book's ship, mm-hmm. and she overheard all of this and must have explained it to Michael at some point during that episode. But I think Michael's understanding of it is Tarka loved that person, that individual, as much as she loves Book. So mm-hmm. that was her read of it.
Right, yeah.
You know, I can't remember if I mentioned this at the time, but, you know, last week when we were talking about season four specifically, I mentioned I like Tarka, the unlikable character with, you know, he's doing some extremely shady shit. But what it reminded me of, and maybe I did mention this way back when we first talked about it, was Harlan Ellison's original draft of City on the Edge of Forever, where Kirk did try to save, he was going, among other changes, he was going to try and save Edith Keeler?
Yeah. And Spock would have to stop him.
And Spock had to stop him. And he was kind of like, screw the universe, screw everything. My love is going to define me in this key moment. And sort of Roddenberry was like, he's a man of duty, and that's the central difference. Well, Tarka is kind of, he is a man of love in this case. And I, you know, yes, it's beyond dangerous, you know, beyond reckless in many ways. And, you know, I think you could argue he's toxified his kind of remembrance of that relationship. But it's interesting to me that it does reflect, you know, like we put such a high premium on love at times. And that's what Harlan Ellison was interested in that story. And Tarka, at least to some degree, does reflect that.
Tarka reminds me of Soren in Generations, where he's trying to get back to the Nexus, and it's okay with him that he's going to live the rest of his life in a fake, made-up environment. That's what Tarka gives the vibes for me.
Yeah, that's very, very selfish. Well,
it is, yeah. I guess he thinks he's going to actually make it, right, to the alternate universe.
It's gonna be fake.
By the end, I think he didn't make it. He wasn't sure if he was gonna have like enough energy to cross over or not. But I think it was just he didn't have anything else to live for. So
was it gonna be fake? Or was it gonna be like that's actually where his?
Well, it was gonna be an alternate universe. But
that where his buddy escaped to though?
That's his assumption. He doesn't know that for a fact. But when he went back to the lab, he left the sign of like, oh, I went to the universe. So.
Yeah, I figured he seems like he's a very calculating, smart dude, and that, you know, he would at least
He's operating a lot on faith, so that tells you a lot about where his his values are, you know, that he'll compromise his intellectual values for his his selfish
But I did like values. That as a, again, as a counterpoint maybe somewhat to the wholesomeness of Trek at times, of Discovery in particular.
But that is a very, that's a very common thing in Star Trek is something that Roddenberry is really focused on in the original series, and I think that's why you have like more badmiral type characters show up. But the idea of like there is an ugly side to human nature, and it is something that we have to grapple with and deal with. Kind of like later Roddenberry in the 70s and 80s kind of, I don't know, he kind of changed his philosophies a little bit. But early Roddenberry definitely wanted that to be reflected in the show, that humanity must always be very self-reflective and self-critical.
You know, Book lost sight of that in that last season that we saw. He was rolling with Tarka, and sometimes I didn't 100% buy him doing that, but, you know, I can't say that I've experienced having a planet destroyed.
Yeah, and the fact that it kept happening, that it was like a recurring thing, that like, oh yeah, somebody needs to like take action now. There's just like another 11 billion died. Oh look, here's like another several billion died. I can see that being like, okay, we're gonna have to do something quick. So that would be a motivating factor to take action, take a big swing, as the Strange New Worlds writers would say.
Let's see. What was I going to mention? Father, you had brought up, since we're talking about relationships and love, one of my favorite episodes in, I guess this goes back to season two. What was the name of the one that had Vina and it had the Talosians?
Oh, If Memory Serves.
If Memory Serves.
Yes. And they did that very cool opening recap that called back, the original series, which was such a fun thing to do. They got to reimagine all of that. And, is that the same one in which Pike finds out that what his future fate will be?
No. That came a little bit later.
That's with the time. That was when
Kenneth Mitchell is an albino Klingon and gives him a crystal that right. shows that to him.
But I liked the cool thing about that episode, of course, aside from just this sort of nostalgic element of seeing a, you know, a new interpretation of the Talosians, was that Pike was, you know, that we saw that this was a kind of, his thing with Vina was real, and that we the viewers at least would know that he was, you know, for all the tragedy he was going to endure, that he would sort of get this.
Pike will eventually like go to heaven. Like he will go to Talos IV and get to live with the woman he's in love with, and get to like live like any fantasy of the Talosians can create, like anything for him. Like Amy was saying, I guess like Tarka, it would still be fake. But I mean, like it's like at the end of his life, it's like you're not gonna have like anything else. So it's like
you have reality. You have reality. And okay, can we just talk about this? I was texting you, Fathery, while I was watching this. Okay, here Vina is and reveals to you, and how would you, as Captain Pike, this person who I thought that I loved, who I won't love anymore because they're creepy, created me and has been living with a version of me this entire time. And Geordi gets all this crap for recreating Leah Brahms. No, I don't think so. That is not cool.
Doesn't she say that the Talosians did that for her? Like she didn't.
She was like, but then I want to be with him. Like how would you feel literally like, someone has been living with a version of me. Not cool. Creepy vibes. 100%.
So you think it's too Barclay style?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, what's that?
You know, I actually think it would have been better if they didn't include that, because I've always been this is like a weird, like, canon debate that I would have to go on, like, a weird, like, canon tangent, but, you know, like, old school, like, Star Trek rules used to be that the cage was non-canon, but, like, I don't know, around, like, 20, 30 years ago, people stopped talking about that, so I don't know if it still sticks or not, but that was the idea that, like, the cage was not canon, because it didn't actually air, it wasn't part of the actual aired episodes, but that is the ending in the cage, that the Talusians create like a copy of Jeffrey Hunter for Vina to live with.
Yeah,
I didn't rewatch the entire episode, so I'm coasting a little on nostalgia for the nostalgia presented. I'm curious to rewatch it now and see what I think. I think to some degree, Vina had her own tragedy, and I'd have to kind of watch it and see. I mean, you know, we're into this weird Matrix type territory where it's like, is it immoral to live a fantasy, you know, and or if so, how, you know, at what point, you know, is too long to hold on to it? But also, I don't know, like, kind of what other life she could have on Talos. You know, to some degree, they originally set those chess pieces up in TOS, and they set it up so that they could get a particular result. They wanted to have, you know, Pike, you know, eventually return there and all that. And, but yeah, I'll have to revisit that when I'm curious.
Well, the original intent was that he wouldn't return.
Right, so that's why that would have had that.
It would have had that ending. Right. Yeah, so with the menagerie actually omits that, like, that never happened. And I was happy when that was the universe, but then Discovery came along and kind of added that back in. Not a big deal, but it's just kind of like, I kind of liked when that wasn't canon, but I guess it is. So,
out of curiosity, like, what other episodes have stood out for y'all? Disco has a lot of large tapestry stories, and so there's not maybe as many specifically isolated episodes as we've gotten in other treks, but anyway, what other ones for y'all?
Just to highlight season 3, because I feel like we haven't talked about it much, but there was a fun return to the Trill homeworld in season 3, so I really appreciated that. That was another big highlight.
Was that was when Adira was trying to remember, draw back some memories?
Well, they were having to figure out what to do with the Trill symbiote, but the Gray passed to Adira.
Right.
From Trill to a human. Yeah, that was when they were trying to get back to Starfleet. So, like, they, you know, they go to Earth and they find Adira, and then it's like, oh, well, we need to get, like, your Admiral memories. And then there's this part of, like, that quest that eventually gets them back to Starfleet when they meet Admiral Vance and see the post-burn Starfleet.
Right, right.
See, I think when you ask that question, like, what's a favorite episode of yours? It's too difficult to answer with this type of story form. Because when you say the Trill episode, but then there's so much that leads up to it beforehand that makes that episode so amazing, is the build up. So it's like when you say, what's your favorite episode? Like, it's almost like, what's a storyline that, you know, stands out to you? Otherwise, you're going to Magic to Make the Insanest Man Go Mad, because that's an episodic. Right. That's a sort of, you know, just this little bite of a story. It's so difficult answering that question in Discovery. One episode of season 3 that I do remember liking, and I haven't got there in my rewatch, so you'll have to help me out, but is this episode 2, Far From Home. And that was sort of a fun episode because we are getting the crew now in the future. Right. And they're like, you know, the two Starfleet walk into a bar, or, you know, it's this fish out of water story that, you know, I can relate to. And we're being introduced to, where are they now? When are they now? And is that the first time that we see a programmable matter?
Programmable matter. Close? Yeah. Yeah. I guess it would be. Yeah. Yeah. Cause they have to explain that.
Is that the one with the mining station and all that?
Yeah.
And the big glaciery.
Yeah. Like they brought back the coordinates from Enterprise season 1 that Dave and I just covered a few months ago, but from the, you know, weird random episode of Enterprise.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I forgot about that.
The Discovery does that sometimes. Every now and then Discovery will do like a really like deep cut Star Trek alien.
Well, you, Father, what were the aliens that were in the examples episode?
Colony. Yeah, they were from the Enterprise episode, Civilization, the Akali?
Yeah.
But they were the people who on Enterprise, they're like Renaissance era. But then in Discovery in the 32nd century, they're, you know, a space traveling member of the intergalactic community.
Looks like they evolved. That episode that you just mentioned, Amy, had the one of those Saru moments I really like, when he and Tilly are going to that station or that outpost, and she's not sure why he brought her along, and I don't remember all the details of it, but that's his... He said like, you and Zentilly are a very good first impression, or something like that.
That's when you really see him make like the shift to like the more paternal, the softer type of, you know, when he's leading by through compassion, like, you know, when he's able to be comforting to the people he's also commanding. You know, early Saru never felt like he was confident enough. He always had to be very stern.
And he was always second guessing himself. Like, what are the characteristics of the best captains? You know, like, but he was, you know, trying to self improve, and now he's, you know, had those seasons to mature.
Yeah, the guy that you have who had that conversation with Tilly in season 3, and then, you know, the evolution that he goes on to commanding the Enterprise, or I'm sorry, commanding the Discovery in season 3, and then the stuff they did with him in season 4, and whatever will happen in the final season. But the guy that he turned into there wouldn't have tortured the tardigrade to try to save Lorca in season 1, like the younger Saru, the less confident Saru was doing.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a much more personal style of kind of leadership and crew interaction on Discovery. And like at the end of that episode, I believe when Burnham is reunited with them, right? And Saru gets the captaincy again. Is that right? Or I remember seeing a scene where he's reclaiming the captaincy, and she like holds his hand while they're doing it.
Yeah, when she comes back on board Discovery, because season 3, we get the first episode of just her and Book, and is like all about that. And then they do the second episode of, okay, now Discovery lands in the 32nd century, and it's all about them. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of that episode is when they all get back together.
But yeah, just that closeness, you know, it is a little bit, there is more of a family element maybe to this, than even though there's a family element in all Star Treks, there's more to this one than the others, especially with, say, Culber and Stamets as their adopted dads for Adira and Gray, Zora becoming like a literal part of the crew. In the end, you know, they look, it looks so different from the way, say, Lorca was running it in season 1, which was...
I'm happy for them, though. Like, they got away from that. You know, like, if you go back and watch Context is for Kings, and I don't know, they kind of all seem terrified, you know, working for, like this kind of madman general who just wants to, like, win the war, and, you know, he's just gonna, like, crack the whip. You know, it's just, like, this old school commander. I'm so happy for... Like, now they get to, like, hang out in a bar and stuff. It's a much happier ship. In later Discovery than early Discovery.
Although everybody is always processing trauma, too. There's a lot of trauma in Disco. Ugh.
Yeah, but season 5 looks to be a lot more optimistic and less tragic. There's been a lot of tragedy.
That's true. You know, speaking of, you were talking to me about stuff with long buildups. Season 4 was that, you know, long buildup to, you know, they had a big bad, but in this case, the big bad wasn't so bad. It wasn't Control, and it wasn't Lorca or the Klingon Empire. It was a, you know, and some of my favorite episodes include like Rosetta and the actual, I think it's just called Species 10C episode, where we did, you know, get to see them, and it was a little bit more that sort of 2001-ish vibe of contact or Close Encounters, contact, things like that. So that was exciting to see, and again, based on a whole season of sort of build up. So, you know, those episodes sort of they're still part of it. Although there were standalone episodes in there too, from Casino episode to, the one I really liked, the examples with, notable performance from Michael Gray Eyes as the prisoner who stays behind. What about you, Father? Any episodes or arcs, I guess I'd say, maybe, that stood out for you in the various seasons?
The Sound of Thunder in season 2, when they go to Saru's homeworld for the first time. I was so glad that we actually got to see Kaminar. Yeah. It was such a missed opportunity that Star Trek Enterprise introduced us to like this really cool new alien character, Dr. Phlox. And oh, we had a new alien species, the Denobulans. I just kind of assumed, okay, at some point they're going to, probably not in season one, but at some point this show is going to take me to the Denobulan homeworld. I'm going to get like a whole Denobulan episode, you know? That never happened. And that was, I don't know, I feel like that was like a big missed opportunity. We still have never been to the Denobulan homeworld, but I'm glad Discovery did not make that same mistake. I think that would have been a huge omission if we never saw Saru's people and his culture, and I think that kind of helped, you know, realize him as more of a character. And I like the story with the Ba'ul and kind of the, they had like this long historic conflict. I like it more now because I've seen season four when they all are thriving and getting along. And I guess they were able to work out a one state solution with equal rights for Ba'uls and Kelpians. And I'm happy to see that was maintained as much as things got really bad during the burn and, you know, the Federation almost completely erased, you know, was reduced from, what, like 300 member planets to I don't remember, they had like 60 or 30 or something, but Kaminar, they did not lose their peaceful, stable society. The Ba'ul and Kelpians continued to coexist. So I like
because
that.
Isn't there an episode in Enterprise where Archer, Dr. Phlox, and they won, and it was the two species on the planet, and then they were like, well, one's gonna die out, and one's gonna, and then one do they help? Then that's
right,
the one
because there was a slightly dear impressive doctor.
Yes, that's the one.
I like that one, although you pointed out when we talked about it, Father, they somewhat present only a sort of binary solution, you know, right. do you help the sort of slightly manipulative, controlling faction, or do you help the other, you know, or do you not help them and let the other faction essentially ascend and likely take over the planet over time?
So to your point, Father, I like to see them in season four, when you know their history of that it was the Kelpians that were, you know, being bad to the Ba'ul, and then the Ba'ul became in control, and then they were being bad. So it's like this back and forth.
They tried to erase history, the Ba'ul, when they're in control too. I thought that was interesting how they try to, you know, rewrite the narrative, and they're like, oh no, we're the predators now, and you're the prey, and we're supposed to be the dominant species.
Right. But I mean, you sort of can understand, you know, when the Kelpians were so mean to him. So, and mean is too nice of a word, but you know what I mean. So, but yeah, to see that it's like, okay, again, that's just like, I love season four, with that Trek philosophy of, yes, we, no matter what, we can get to be together. You
know? We will be friends with the scary tar monster.
Well, yeah, yes. they show the council meeting with, where Saru is and everything. And you know, the Ba'ul are still scary looking. They're like floating in, like they're in a screen, or they're somewhere behind them. And then they still look scary, but they have clearly integrated and they have their voice in the council and everything.
That's when you got to remember what Trip Tucker's Vulcan high school teacher told them, that you have to challenge your preconceptions before they challenge you.
Good job, Trip's teacher.
Yay for teachers.
Yeah.
Teacher appreciation. But Dave, did you have any other like episodes you wanted, or story arcs that you wanted to comment
on?
Let's
see. I mentioned Context is for Kings. I mentioned the examples. You know, one I needed to rewatch, but I remember enjoying, was New Eden. That's another kind of standalone episode.
Which I'm convinced Akiva Goldsman wanted to do that as a proof of concept for Strange New World. He's like, look, this Anson Mount guy, he's going to be my captain, and we're going to do Planet of the Week type episodes like this. Here's an example. So
there you go,
because that one was written by Akiva, and it was like, I'm also very convinced that the season four episode, was it All Things Are Possible or All Is Possible, but that was a proof of concept for the Starfleet Academy show.
I think you're right, to be honest. I mean, it makes a lot of sense that they would do those are cool episodes, but they also feel like, you know, I can see that they would serve a very practical purpose, too.
And the season two episode, Point of Light, I think they were kind of trying to do a proof of concept on Section 31. That was when they introduced Michelle Yeoh as the Section 31 operative, and they introduced Leyland before he was Control, when he was just a Section 31 guy.
Mm-hmm. Can I go on a love fest for Species 10C and that story arc?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh my gosh. It's going to take a while, so just sit back. But I freaking love this whole story from beginning to end of how do you deal with the unknown? And we get both sides, right? We get Tarka and Book, who are wanting to take on the aggressive. We're getting the Starfleet. I don't know. Is it Federation back then? Starfleet and Burnham. That's going to give them the benefit of the doubt because we don't know. How are you going to, you know, deal with something that happens and you don't know the intent, which is what happens in our lives a lot. Like something happens to us. Yeah. We don't know what is the intent. And like, how do you deal with your assumptions and that whole back and forth? And to have Starfleet and Burnham stand up and say, we need to communicate, period. We're not going to fight back, even though we've lost this. We need to figure out the intent first. Like, that is Starfleet. That is philosophy that I want to live by. And the fact, and so creative, that they're having this Species 10C communicate in light and color and timing. Like, I freaking love it, because how difficult is it to communicate with someone that's not like you? It's freaking difficult. And here they're not even using words. Like, it's just insanity. And the fact that they use logic statements to get there, which is math, and I'm a former math teacher. The whole thing of season 4 and Species 10C, like, I freaking love. And I will excuse whatever other bad storylines you say. Season 4 is the best season of Discovery because of 10C.
So far. Season 5 might be better, but I agree with you. I absolutely love season 4. I heaped a ton of praise on it a couple of weeks ago when we were focusing on it. But yeah, that's a great point, though. We got the hard sci-fi stuff communicating with the 10C, but it made sense for the theme of the story arc of season 4 of communication and how hard it is to communicate, especially when people are that different from you.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there was a neat bit in the when they were in the council chambers and they had Federation people, but also non-Federation people there. Mm-hmm. And Book makes his case and yes. Burnham makes her case. And, you know, they play with the idea, of course, you know, that Book gives a pretty moving testament. But in the end, even these people who have survived the burn, they have lived under the threat of the and reign of the Emerald Chain and all of this. They still sided with Burnham, you know? That's the reason why Book and Tarka had to go renegade and all that stuff, mm-hmm. was because in the end, the people did, you know, they chose, let's try and communicate with them. That was still the priority, and that's some people who are under duress, mm-hmm. too. They've been living without dilithium for, like, 100 years, or whatever it's been.
Yeah, but I like what that says about, like, I don't know, that kind of has a larger, I guess, humanist message of, like, when you go, yes. like, issue by issue, like, the average person is actually, you know, they're actually, like, going to be on the right side of a lot of stuff when you can break it down in, like, an honest framing. And that's an important thing, I guess, to keep in mind, too, when you have a hard time communicating with the people that are different than you, that, like, you know, we do have, like, a lot of common ground. So, but yeah, mm-hmm. I love how season 4, like, all of that stuff, it just works together so well. Discovery mm-hmm. has kind of had, like, this weird kind of identity crisis, you know, how could it not, you know, changing showrunners constantly, you know, Brian Fuller didn't even make it into, like, shooting of season 1, and then they fired the season 1 showrunners early in season 2. And, you know, it took a while before Michelle Paradise could kind of actually, like, have reign over the show for a while and stabilize things. But yeah, season 4 definitely had a consistent story and tone and yes. theme.
Yeah.
But I also kind of like that Disco was so schizophrenic in the earlier years and was just kind of all over the place. I think it kind of added to the variety of weirdness that we've gotten in the show. So, you know, crazy things like the sphere data, you know, that, like, and like now we have, like, this Zora ship, but that was, like, I don't know, a very different thing in Opal for Charon in season 2.
Mm-hmm. I found it interesting that in this discussion, season 3 has been least talked about with storyline, you know, and I happen to agree. I don't like season 3.
That's funny. It's my least favorite season, I think, also.
I think could to me, Control was maybe my least favorite threat, but I like the burn as a baseline concept, not necessarily as executed, but like as something, you know, the powerful, you know, galactic civilization that we built found, you know, was humbled by some sort of a natural thing of, you know, essentially a shortage of resources. I think that's a cool idea that there was a setback for the Federation on a massive scale. Now I hate the revelation about it. It's terrible. But I think I like that season maybe a little bit more than season two for the stuff in it that did work. I have actually always struggled a little bit with Michelle Yeoh's character, even though she kind of spiced up the, you know, any given scene she was in. And also, she was like, she is a war criminal. And, you know, it was a little hard for me to completely put that behind me. And I was like, she was mean to Tilly and a lot of other people. That's not cool. I don't like that. So her kind of role, her doing Section 31 stuff was not my favorite thing.
Yeah, I said at the time, like, Terra Firma did a better job redeeming her than I would have thought possible. So I thought she was irredeemable. I thought, like, there's no way I'll ever be able to root for this character.
Was that the Guardian of Forever?
Yeah, that I had to eat crow when we got through that, because I was like, I feel like they convinced me that she's willing to atone for her sins and live a better life wherever the Guardian sends her to be in the Section 31 movie coming to Paramount Plus probably later this year.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm looking forward to. I really am. I like Georgiou. Emperor or Captain.
Even when she's mean to them.
Yes.
Well, Dave, you often said that the show needed that extra bit of arch. They needed to have some Georgiou on the ship, but it was too wholesome without
and
that.
And her jousting with Leland and Control, absolutely loved it.
Now, I do think they needed that, but like she was almost like a little bit too much. You know, it'd be like if you have Khan strolling around on your ship, it's a, like he's going to be dramatic and he's not going to be wholesome.
That sounds awesome. There should be a Star Trek story where like you're forced to team up with Khan and he's got to be on your ship and you got to figure out a way to make that work. That sounds like a good story opportunity.
For an episode or two? Yes. But she had much more reign than that. So
Only around a couple of episodes. And, you know, she is Khan type because it's Michelle Yeoh. Like, she's on screen, you see Khan. Like, she's just that huge, that magnanimous. Like, Michelle Yeoh is amazing. And she really is only there a couple episodes. Like, I really could do a few more.
When she showed up at the end of season one, wasn't she essentially given command of the ship by?
Yes, but yes. we were supposed to be uncomfortable with that. Like, we're supposed to be like, Cornwell, what the hell are you doing?
And then they connected her with Section 31.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that was after she went rogue on Kronos and then 31 recruited her.
Yep. Yep.
But you know, when they're having to work with it, like it's a, you know, she kind of stayed on as part of the crew. And listen, I love Michelle Yeoh. It's kind of a love hate thing when she's around. I like her presence, but it's the part that feels least Star Trek-y to me. It actually feels like it's kind of grinding on the Star Trek principles. It's like if they had Jellicoe around all the time. Or not all the time, but much more often. Let's say much more often. And I like Jellicoe too, by the way.
But like, what if you have like a Ferengi criminal as like a bartender as a regular on your show? Like, I think it's okay to have some of these like these very like non Starfleet people, some very people who are like very like not Roddenberry philosophies. I like having them on the show too.
You remember how Quark though was like, you know, I'm not going to commit war crimes for whoever that was who was trying to push him into that. But like that's already part of like Georgiou's history. She has eaten Kelpians. She has murdered and tortured millions. Just that always stayed with me as something that needed to be addressed and was not to maybe to my satisfaction.
Well, maybe one day Dave will learn.
Put her on trial. But I know Jill in the audience has my back. She's, I think, even less tolerant of me than.
You're definitely not alone with that sentiment. But she did bounce off of the show though. So if that was If that was an issue for you, if you didn't like Giorgio on Discovery, then you're in luck post season.
Was she out in the entire season four?
Yeah, she does not appear in any of after.
And what
after
was the best
season? After she leaves halfway through season three, she stays gone.
I'm going into courtroom mode. I'm like, and what was the best season? Season.
But yeah, I'll agree with you. It is four, but I think you were right when you said that season four kind of they needed someone to be a little bit of a jerk, and then we kind of got that with Tarka.
Yeah, sometimes I miss old Stamets even a little bit.
I think we're gonna get that with Captain Rayner, our new captain in season five.
Right, that's like the other ship that they may work with or something.
Yeah, but speaking of that, he's a what are they called? Kurenites? They were just in one episode of DS9, Armageddon Games, but that's Michelle Paradise was
this is the speculation about
South
the alien by, his so, alien race.
Yeah, yeah. So Michelle Paradise confirmed at the South by premiere when she was here in Austin that he is the race from Armageddon Games. But that's I like how I was mentioning how Disco will occasionally have like these deep cut races, or they brought back for whatever reason the Lurians and Cardassians are like running around in season four. It's like, hey, people like Deep Space Nine, so let's throw in some Morns and Gold Ducats running around in the background. They did get like a little bit more like experimental, I guess, with like the Strange New Life and New Civilizations when, you know, we have like the Giuseppe and the mycelial network, and Saru is so much more alien than most of our regular characters. You know, he's just visually he's very different.
Yeah, only Linus kind of matched his quirky his alienness, and Linus was kind of a bit more of a tongue in cheek character.
That was another fun thing with Linus, you know, the Saurians, and like bringing in some of the motion picture aliens. Yeah. And in season three, they also have the Beetlejuicean. The rival courier, what was his name? Cosmo, I think that book's rival.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
in the season three premiere. So,
you know, I want to quick mention having dissed Giorgio. I want to quick mention a few, like one of the things that they do is big spectacle in Discovery, and there's a lot of action and stuff. And there have been several notable kind of cool action sequences, several of which Giorgio's been a part of. In that, in season one, there was like a big old hand to hand fight in the corridor in the mirror universe with like her and Burnham versus Lorca's.
Yeah, the throne room fight is really.
Yeah, okay, was it
there was a corridor battle, and then after that, they have like the throne room.
Right. Mm-hmm. The corridor battle had more phasers and stuff, and then the second one had like knives and swords and martial arts, and you know she's always going to rock that. She also got to. There was like a barroom fight with a dude in the beginning of season three, whatever that episode was. It was episode two, you know, the one we were just talking about with the miners.
Far from home.
Yeah, that dude had been like pushing her, and he was like phasering her on low power.
Oh yeah, yeah, and she's ready to fight someone.
And then it's always great to see Michelle. You know,
the fight with Leyland at the end of season two, like I have a lot of problems with Such Sweet Sorrow. I don't really like how like the Red Angel storyline ended. But the choreography is great, and when like the gravity malfunctions and they're like going like up on top of the corridor and on the side and everything, and the way they shot it, I think they were just spinning the set around, but it looks so cool, and Jeff Russo's score is so good. Like whenever there's dumb season finales that I don't like, the score is always so good. It can almost kind of trick me into like. Like when Michael's like flying in the Red Angel suit and like the score is just like so freaking good. I'm like, man, like I just can't help but like enjoy this. It's something that I've noticed in like a lot of filmmakers I don't like Michael Bay or Jerry Bruckheimer do like the really like schlocky action movies. They always get composers that can do like these epic scores that are like, you know, I'm not a good enough filmmaker to make you feel any emotions, but the composer is going to do it with the music. So but I think Jeff Russo's score doesn't get much appreciation. I clearly like his work more than a lot of people, but I think he's had a lot of good work in Disco. A lot of like the not typical Star Trek stuff, like whenever he's doing like dark ominous music, like the Mirror Universe stuff, or like a lot of like the Klingon stuff, that always sounds really cool.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good call out. These are massive team efforts, and you know the FX guys and the music guys, they're all trying to work to do the same thing, you know, or they're working towards the same goal, even if they're getting there a little differently.
Amy, do you have any other big highlights of Star Trek Discovery that we haven't covered yet that you'd like to mention, like to get on the record before we sign off?
One thing that I do like about Discovery, sort of overall, is sort of their conservation philosophy, you know, like the, what were the things that Book was bringing to the planet he was
the
rescuing?
The trance worms? The,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then not, you know, abusing the tardigrade, like it was sentient. We need to not abuse it, you know, and like not enslaving them or those space whales that was an endangered,
oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You know, so this whole idea of conservation in a time where our Earth is dying, and if we don't do something to change, it's going to die, and then the people will die on the Earth. I really appreciate Discovery taking that stance, and I just feel it's a great philosophy to have, and I hope we get to see more of that in season 5.
I haven't heard anyone else point that out, but I think that Star Trek Discovery is the most environmentalist
yes.
Star Trek show.
Yeah.
Yes.
It comes up with sort of the mycelial aliens yeah. as well, even though yeah. I think to some degree the show didn't quite have the follow-through I wanted on that, where they had to kind of really reckon with the
yeah.
sort of danger.
Yeah, that was kind of confusing, too. That's one thing that, like, sometimes Discovery can get real muddy, and it takes a while to get clarification on some of that stuff. Apparently the mycelial network was only in danger because of Kolber's presence there. And then after they removed him, it was they were no longer damaging
it. But then did it get cleaned up with his removal? Like, how did it get cleaned
up?
That's
yeah. what's like implied that, but it didn't explain
right.
that very well. But
no,
you know,
at this point,
the show is like, well, why do I want to mess with that? You know, I'm doing like this other 32nd century stuff now. And it's the same thing with, like, there is so much confusion about, like, why do people blame Michael Burnham for starting the war? Like, she, like, her mutiny really didn't start it, but I always, like, kind of blame her for, like, she killed Takuvma when her and Georgiou went to go capture him, and that's kind of, you know, that's kind of what could have stopped things. If anyone wants mm-hmm. to be mad at her, they should be mad about that. But, like, what the show it doesn't want to, like, go back and try to explain that stuff. Now, that's why I don't think we're going to get an explanation on Calypso, on the Short Trek Calypso in season 5. But I think that's okay, because I'm just assuming Zora had a dream. I think that's the reason why they gave her the ability to dream in season 4. So it's just, oh, yeah, one time I had a dream about a dude named Kraft, you know? Dave, what about you? Anything else on Star Trek Discovery?
Just kind of skimming through my notes. I've just got odds and ends stuff to mention. Spock's beard, that's a pretty good look for him. I want to mention, I liked it was something that they kind of dropped, but early on when they were a little bit more edgelord, when they had their first F-bomb, I still like it. I think it was fun. I liked that it was Tilly and Stamets and Burnham hanging out and
talking. That's right,
science.
Cadet. It is fucking cool.
Yep. Sarek, I like Sarek's most of his appearances, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, James and, you know, Frayne did a good job.
Yeah.
Him explaining the Vulcan hello to Michael, and periodically being there as a rather, kind of a kinder father to her than he was to Spock.
Very, very much.
Only because she called him out on it.
A lot of dads are nicer to their daughters than sons.
That's an interesting point, Fathery. There's a bunch of little things, Tilly as Captain Killy, just lots of fun moments like that. There's, you know, I could, you know, just go through there. Saru getting the threat ganglia changing to those little dart things that he can shoot out.
Attack
did you not ganglia? Like?
I did not like the darts. I like the ganglia falling out, but the darts, no.
I thought that was cool. I mean, it's just a neat little visual flourish and kind of, I guess emphasizes pray no longer. let's see. I think that's most of the stuff. You know, we in some way, shape, or form covered most of what I wanted to talk about, I think.
Word.
What about you, Fathery?
One last thing is I like Mama Burnham. I like that Michael like thought that she had lost her parents, and it turned out like, no, your mom was your guardian angel all along, and she was actually there, you know, watching your graduation from the Vulcan Science Academy and all the, you know, big important things in your life, and she's a part of your life. And then now in the 32nd century, when, you know, this whole crew that followed you here and said goodbye to their families, you had no reason to expect you would get this, Michael, but it turns out, like, oh, your mom is here, and you actually get to, like, have a relationship with your mom now that you hadn't gotten to have since you were a little kid. And I think that's a wonderful thing for that poor girl who's been through so much fucking trauma over the years, of just everything she's had to endure. So I'm very happy that Michael Burnham had that, and I thought it was like really good casting. They got an actress who had a similar southern accent to Sonequa Martin Green, and I thought they had like good mother-daughter chemistry, and
yes.
I'm hoping that we get more Mama Burnham in season five as well.
Yeah. Hey, what about the cinematography of Discovery and like the A, is it the A?
The AR wall, yeah. They gave us the, they get better with that ever, like it looked pretty good in season four. It looked even better in season one of Strange New Worlds. It looked even better in season two of Strange New Worlds.
Yes. Yeah. And, it's getting better and better, but we got that there with Discovery.
Yeah, I'm hoping like with season five, I think they can do like some really cool stuff with it. And see, I think like the best AR wall shit that we've gotten is yet to be seen. We're going to get it in a few weeks in season five.
Yeah, like, their vision of various planetary surfaces or spaceships and stuff feel very well realized. You mentioned the transworms. I think you actually see one in one episode. Is it somewhere on
a beach? It swallows Michael and then
spits her, right.
her up. Yeah.
But look, on the beach. Look pretty cool.
It did what the spider cow did to Boimler.
Yeah, Lower Decks. Just gnawing on it.
My only issue has ever been that it's like a little too showy at times. You know, the camera's spinning around.
They
rein
that in, though. They get better over the years. They stop the spinniness. Amy, you used to bitch about that all the time. I remember listening to your podcast, like season one, talking about you getting vertigo from the camera spinning around.
Every episode, I'm like, why are we spinning? And they would start upside down, and it annoyed the shit out of me.
Olentunde heard you, and he stopped doing that. So
thank you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to season five, though. Y'all got me pretty excited for it, talking about like all the things that we like in the previous four seasons. So I think that'll be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Another thank you to the Text Trek Patreon supporters out there. We do appreciate it. And if you're unable to join the Patreon but still want to help out, you can subscribe to the YouTube channel and rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcast and Spotify. But Dave and I will be back next week. We're going to try to get Captain Pikachu back on the show to discuss the top 3 things we want to see in Star Trek Discovery Season 5 and one thing we don't want to see. So
yeah,
that might be interesting.
That'll be fun. I've got a few. I feel like I have a few like lighter answers in there, too, that extending beyond the 3. But yeah, we're going to keep it the big stuff focused on one thing. And I think I have some things that I don't think we're going to cross over too much, Fathery. I think we'll have some
not
unique
have much
different
overlap.
Things. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Because we never know. We don't reveal these to each other.
That's right. So secretive.
And Dave and I both came up with these before we saw any of season 5. So this is going to be completely unreflective of what's
no
actually
cheating.
In season 5. Just our hopes and fears on display for all to see. That'll be next
3
week,
hopes, 1 fear.
Yeah, 3 hopes, 1 fear next week.
Yeah.
And then 2 discos the week after that. Teacher, what does that add up to? What's the solution to that problem? Maybe someone will figure it out by next week, but...
The answer is, that's the power of math, people!
There you go. Connected back to Star Trek Discovery. It all ties together.
That's right. It is fucking cool.
Well, it'll be fucking cool next week when we talk about more Star Trek Discovery. And until then, as always... Live long and prosper, y'all.
Listen to the Text Trek podcast through Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or at text-trek.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/text-trek. And follow Fathery on Twitter at TXTrek. Please support us by liking our videos and subscribing to our channel on YouTube. Thank you and take care.